Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Book 2, Chapter 6, grinding through these very difficult to read chapters. We're getting there though, and I think it's going to come together soon. I'm not sure if I'm becoming fatigued and that's why the sentences are not making sense to me, or if they're just don't make sense, essentially. Am I trying to make sense out of nonsense, or am I just incapable of making sense of it? Anyway, let's dive in. This is Book 2, Chapter 6 of Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. Kutuzov fell back towards Vienna, destroying behind him the bridges over the rivers Inn at Brunau and Traun near Linz. On October 23rd, the Russian troops were crossing the river Enns. At midday, the Russian baggage train, the artillery, and columns of troops were defiling through the town of Enns on both sides of the bridge. It was a warm, rainy, autumnal day. The wide expanse that opened out before the heights on which the Russian batteries stood guarding the bridge was at times veiled by a diaphanous curtain of slanting rain, and then, suddenly spread out in the sunlight, far distant objects could be clearly seen, glittering as though freshly varnished. Down below, the little town could be seen with its white, red-roofed houses, its cathedral, and its bridge on both sides of which streamed jostling masses of Russian troops. At the bend of the Danube, vessels, an island, and a castle with a park surrounded by the waters of the confluence of the Enns and the Danube became visible, and the rocky left bank of the Danube, covered with pine forests with a mystic background of green treetops and bluish gorges. The turrets of a convent stood out beyond a wild virgin pine forest, and far away on the other side of the Enns, the enemy horse patrols could be discerned. Among the field guns, on the brow of the hill, the general in command of the rear guard stood with a staff officer scanning the country through his field glass. A little behind them, Nesvitsky, who had been sent to the rear guard by the commander-in-chief, was sitting on the trail of a gun carriage. A Cossack, who accompanied him, had handed him a knapsack and a flask, and Nesvitsky was treating some officers to pies and a real doppelkümmel. The officers gladly gathered round him, some on their knees, some squatting in Turkish fashion on the wet grass. At this point of the book there is a map superimposed between the paragraphs. It's titled Sketch Map 1, Illustrating Campaign of 1805. If you look at the description of this podcast, you'll find a link to view the picture for yourself if you would like to. Yes, the Austrian prince who built that castle was no fool. It's a fine place. Why are you not eating anything, gentlemen? Nesvitsky was saying. Thank you very much, prince, answered one of the officers, pleased to be talking to a staff officer of such importance. It's a lovely place. We passed close to the park and saw two deer, and what a splendid house. Look, prince, said another, who would have dearly liked to take another pie, but felt shy, and therefore pretended to be examining the countryside. See, our infantrymen have already got there. Look, they're in the meadow behind the village. Three of them are dragging something. They'll ransack that castle, he remarked with evident approval. So they will, said Nesvitsky. No, but what I should like, added he, munching a pie in his moist-lipped handsome mouth, would be to slip in over there. He pointed with a smile to a turreted nunnery, and his eyes narrowed and gleamed. That would be fine, gentlemen. The officers laughed. Just to flutter the nuns a bit. They say there are Italian girls among them. On my word, I'd give 5 years of my life for it. They must be feeling dull too, said one of the bolder officers, laughing. Meanwhile, the staff officer standing in front pointed out something to the general, who looked through his field glass. Yes, so it is, said the general angrily, lowering the field glass and shrugging his shoulders. So it is. They'll be fired on at the crossing, and why are they dawdling there? On the opposite side, the enemy could be seen by the naked eye, and from their battery a milk-white cloud arose. Then came the distant report of a shot, and our troops could be seen hurrying to the crossing. Nesvitsky rose puffing and went up to the general, smiling. "Would not your excellency like a little refreshment?" he said. "It's a bad business," said the general, without answering him. "Our men have been wasting time." "Hadn't I better ride over, your excellency?" asked Nesvitsky. "Yes, please do," answered the general, and he repeated the order that had already once been given in detail. "And tell the hussars that they are to cross last and to fire the bridge as I ordered, and the inflammable material on the bridge must be re-inspected." "Very good," answered Nesvitsky. He called the Cossack with his horse, told him to put away the knapsack and flask, and swung his heavy person easily into the saddle. "I'll really call in on the nuns," he said to the officers who watched him smilingly, and he rode off by the winding path down the hill. "Now then, let's see how far it will carry, Captain. Just try," said the general, turning to an artillery officer. "Have a little fun to pass the time." "Crew, to your guns," commanded the officer. In a moment, the men came running gaily from their camp fires and began loading. "One," came the command. Number one jumped briskly aside. The gun rang out with a deafening metallic roar, and a whistling grenade flew above the heads of our troops below the hill and fell far short of the enemy, a little smoke showing the spot where it burst. The faces of the officers and men brightened up at the sound. Everyone got up and began watching the movements of our troops below, as plainly visible as if but a stone's throw away, and the movements of the approaching enemy farther off. At the same instant, the sun came fully out from behind the clouds, and the clear sound of the solitary shot and the brilliance of the bright sunshine merged in a single, joyous and spirited impression. All right, there we have it, another chapter down, and kind of a happy chapter, in a weird way. The chapter sort of starts and ends with this celebration of how beautiful the countryside is. And if you look in the description for this podcast, there's a couple of pictures. There's a picture of the map that was superimposed into the chapter. And I've also put in a picture that was linked on the subreddit by user 100157. And it's a picture of the River Enns, the setting of this chapter. It's really quite a beautiful place. And it's funny, the tone of this chapter. The guns are starting to fire and they're moving off to fight a war. But you don't really sense any fear whatsoever. They really seem quite ecstatic, almost. They seem really cheerful about it. It was a strange thing. It was a very strange thing. And a lot of the comments in the discussion were centered around that. Reddit user Who Was Once Delight said, "I don't know much about the historical perspective, but I feel like Tolstoy is setting up a sense of elation in these chapters to underline the inexperience and naivety of the officers. The officers are treating war like an adventure, and the final line especially seems to promise that everything is just going to get better and better. But I wonder how these guys will feel when they start getting shot at and people start getting wounded and killed. My ideas about the horrors of war could be completely modern. Maybe I'm way off base." The final line in question there is, "Just then the sun came all the way out from behind the clouds, and the beautiful sound of the solitary shot and the shining of the bright sun merged into one cheerful and merry expression." That's as it is in the P&V translation. It was slightly different in the translation we just read. In response to Who Was Once Delight's question, Kansas 57 said, "I'm curious to see how Tolstoy plays out the war. Part of me thinks that he's going to show the characters and the reader the horrors of war after describing it as an adventure. It could be a way of shocking the reader into accepting and seeing the reality of fighting. You have this happy-go-lucky, war-is-fun chapter that elevates the spirits of the characters and the reader, but later on he reveals the brutal reality of war." Yeah, it really was a strange take on this war thing. Not at all how you think of a modern war, you know, this terrifying place which is traumatic to everybody involved. These guys seem to be having a jolly old time of it. I'm going to give a take from our resident expert, Brian E. Denton, from his brilliant Medium blog. If you haven't already looked at Brian's blog, you really should do it. He's done a write-up about every single chapter in this novel, and they're fantastic. Now, the subject of Brian's blog on this chapter was the way that this kind of ugliness was sandwiched between really beautiful descriptions of the land. You've got a beautiful description of the place at the start, and then you've got all these sort of brutal human instincts, and the, you know, they even make jokes about like pillaging the nunnery, that kind of thing. And then at the end, you've got another beautiful presentation of the scenery. Now, here's another quote from Brian's blog. He said, "The presentation of such sharp dynamics is a classic Tolstoyan literary technique we'll encounter many more times as we progress through the novel. He often employs this technique during a battle scene or as the prelude to a battle scene. To me, what Tolkien is trying to express is that nature, in all its wide, eternal grandeur, is absolutely indifferent to the human struggle. That is to say, no matter the folly, the feeling, or the frustrations we experience, nature takes no notice. It does not care. We are nearly nothing, just an insignificant part of the whole." That's ice cold, Tolstoy. Ice cold. And such a hard thing to remember at a time like that, when a war is taking place. It's really hard to have an existential crisis while you're fighting for your life. Another thing to note was the change in tense in this chapter, or perspective, I should say. It changes from third person to first person in referring to the troops as our troops. Previously, they would have been referred to as Russian troops. Reddit user Ernie Pook commented on this in the subreddit forum, saying, "I found the transition from Russian troops to our troops in this chapter quite jarring. I'm reading Maud, and I wonder if it's unique to this translation. Can anyone reading the other translations shine some light on this? I actually wondered the same thing." Mag019 said PNV translation is the same. Another user, Mellow Yellow, said, "Yeah, that struck me as well. It's the first time, at least that I've noticed, that the narrator uses a first-person perspective. I'm not sure why Tolstoy makes the switch. To connect the reader further to the characters, to the situation, to the war? The timing of the perspective switch, aligned with the first shots of combat that we experience, can't be a coincidence." Very interesting point. I did find it very jarring. I'd like to get an expert's opinion on that, someone who's really studied the book and the author and could tell us exactly why he's done that. Reddit user DeFleury said, "Nerdy Napoleonic War vocabulary note. Guns have wheels. Gun equals cannon. And the things carried on your shoulder were muskets, which are like rifles except with no grooves in the barrel, which means the ball-shaped ammunition rattles down the tube and flies out at any random angle. Good for hitting the side of a barn or the guy standing beside the guy that you aimed at. Picture me at the bowling alley, and you'll understand why the only effective way to scare anyone with such a weapon was having a whole line of guys stand shoulder to shoulder and fire all at once." Nice little tidbit there. I did not know that. I would have guessed that the musket wasn't very accurate, certainly not as accurate as a modern gun, but I did not know it was so inaccurate. DeFleury goes on to say, "Both Nicholas and Andrew seem to have some clue that the prevailing atmosphere of joking, drinking, and thieving is somehow unsuitable, and their fellow soldiers are not taking the prospect of imminent death very seriously. However, I think at the time most soldiers died of dysentery, not battle wounds. Are they really in any more danger than the folks back home who have parties with bears?" Another great point. That could indeed be why they don't seem too scared at all. Maybe the elation at having such a grand adventure outweighs any fear that they might be feeling. Now, it was quite a short chapter, so I'm going to keep this podcast quite short. I will point out one thing. The people at Podbean who host this podcast, someone said I should contact them and ask if they can promote the podcast. I did that, and they said they were going to give me the top spot podcast of the week or something like that for July, which is really cool. And they asked me, what social media accounts do I have for the podcast? I told them I don't have any, which got me thinking, apparently that's what you have to do. So I put some thought into it. I didn't want to start up, you know, a Twitter or Facebook and everything like that. I wanted to start one new social media account at the most, because I already manage a few different ones. So I went with Instagram, and the reasoning behind that was because I think a visual-based medium is a pretty good matchup for an audio-based product. Kind of, you know, you can get both sides. And also because Instagram is the most sort of mobile phone-centered social media platform. And podcasting is really something that I think 99% of people listen to podcasts on their phone. So it seemed like a good place to sort of capture the audience if anyone wants to engage in a social media thing. So I'm now on Instagram as A Year of War and Peace. It's not the most interesting Instagram page. I really don't know what I'm doing with it. I just set it up because that's what Podbean seemed to think was the done thing. When I link the map in the description, I'll post it on the Instagram and I'll link it to there. That's a pretty easy way for everyone to jump over and have a look. On that housekeeping note, rather boring thing to end on, that's the end of the podcast today. Thanks for listening and I will see you tomorrow.